Oh, once you're sitting comfortably, we can begin with the question baskets. And I should have made the announcement that at the beginning of the retreat, the person who comes up with the best question gets special prize at the end of the retreat. And you know what that prize is? Yes, you know, every retreat. Free haircut for my champion. There we go. In some meditation retreat place, there is an area outside the meditation for people to put their water bottles, bags and books. This will reduce the noise disturbance caused by these items, which are not necessary to do meditation. Feasible here? We have that. We've got this, just outside there, you can see this big row of hooks. So you can put all sorts of things up there. However, many people, they actually want to bring their books in here so they can write notes. They want to bring their water bottles in to drink. So we have to bring these things in here. But the point is, be quiet. Remember, like the burglar. You guys would be hopeless as burglars. You'd have been caught straight away years ago. But here you have to develop the mindfulness of the burglar. So you come in here and you don't make a noise. The same as talking. If you want to talk, talk outside the halls or outside the walking meditation areas. And don't think that whispering can help. People hear every whisper. So it doesn't help whispering, so just go outside. Bringing together yesterday's talk with today's, being with whatever object arises, as one is good enough, versus nudging onto the breath. Which is better and easiest for jhana? Ah, it's no comparison. The first was good. The first talk was right, but not correct. And this morning's talk was correct, but not right. That's what Ajahn Chah used to say. So you can't say which is better than the other. You can use both. Try it out. See which works for you. Because just like every time you have breakfast or lunch in this place, there's such a variety of food on offer. And no one can take something from every dish. Or am I wrong? And it's, I don't know, you guys from Singapore, you're pretty good with the eating. But nevertheless, it's true. I've been watching you. But the same with all the talks and all the advice. You don't have to take everything. Just take that which really suits you. Experiment with it. See if it works. So, but really, the good enough is not the best, but, you know, it's good enough. The Ajahn, if you take refuge and observe the five precepts, do you have some form of help in your meditation? Absolutely, you get huge amounts of help. Number one, you can actually meditate with mindfulness instead of being drunk. You can walk meditation in a straight line instead of going this way and that way if you break your precepts. And it is, because you do get an uplift of happiness and clarity if you keep five precepts. And when you get to the nimitta stage, when a light comes up in your mind, if you've been keeping your precepts, if you've been keeping the rules and being a good meditator, then your nimitta is very beautiful and brilliant. But if you've been naughty, if you've been a scallywag, if you haven't been keeping your precepts, when your nimitta comes up, it's like a dirty old rag. Why? Because you've been naughty, you haven't been doing the right thing. And it's wonderful when that happens, because you can't deceive yourself. That nimitta, that light is brilliant and beautiful, or it's dull and dirty. It's what you've been doing. So, if you really want to have beautiful nimittas, then be a pure-hearted person. If you're a pure-hearted person, it means your mind is pure. And this is what you see at that nimitta stage. It's a reflection of your mind. You're face-to-face with it. You can't deceive yourself any longer. And that is why, in all the years I've been teaching meditation, there are some people who really got pure hearts. You know, they're always giving, they're caring, they never say a bad word about anything, anybody. And they really look after each other. And those are the people, they're really pure-hearted people. When they get nimittas, oh, it's beautiful. They get lots of bliss. And they deserve it. It's their good karma. So yeah, your compassion, your generosity, your goodness, your helping each other, you're keeping the precepts. You really get the payoff big time when you get to nimitta stage of meditation. And that is why it says if you don't have really good precepts, it's very hard to get into jhana. You can do it, there are a few tricks, but it's difficult if you're a really good person. I don't mean like keeping the precepts like some Puritan, like, you know, telling everybody else off, you know, when they're not keeping precepts. I mean like being this really good, pure-hearted person. And you think you know what I mean. Is it rare to meditate in the... Is it safe to meditate in the garden? Will fires, trees or ants or snake visit you? No, this garden is very, very snake, very safe. And all the snakes, they're all Buddhist snakes. So if you keep your precepts, they keep theirs. So now look, it is, you know, in the gardens around here, it's very, 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 very rare to see any snakes in this area over here. They usually like being by the water. So down by the bottom garden, in the bushes there, I don't know, have you ever seen any snakes here? I've never seen any snakes here. So they may be by the water course, but you hardly ever see them. You know, the number of snakes in this place is so small. You know, so I see once a year over the road in Bodhinyana Monastery. And that's all. So they're very, very rare. The chance of you seeing anyone is very, very, very rare. And ants, yeah, there are a few ants around, but you know, you can actually see their nests. So you can actually make sure you don't sit on top of them. Sit somewhere else. So there are plenty of places that if you go searching around, you can find the caretaker's meditation area. You can find another secret meditation garden. No, not that far away. There are some nice places to sit meditation. Try it out. You know, no one's going to harm you. The only sort of big animal around here is kangaroos, and they don't hurt you. They're vegetarians. They're good Buddhists. So it's not as like you've got lions or tigers. Australia is actually quite a safe place. There's very, very, very few sort of dangerous animals here. Yeah, there are venomous snakes, but there's so few of them. You don't ever see them. So it's quite safe. Dear Venerable Sir, what happened when you thought you were enlightened with respect to metta? Okay, when I thought I was enlightened, I found out afterwards I wasn't. And oh, that's really a damn, it really spoils your day. But I've said about that in the book, so you can actually read about that in my book, The Mindfulness Bliss and Beyond. Because sometimes it's very easy to think you're enlightened. But you can tell who's enlightened and who's not. Anyone who says, I am enlightened, then absolutely no way. Because now when you're enlightened, you disappear, you vanish. So it's not some sort of medal they put on your chest. It's not some sort of badge they put on so you can say you're enlightened. You just totally vanish and disappear. Which means a lot of times that you don't know who's enlightened. There's this great story in the suttas of this novice, Sumana, his name was. And he was only a small novice. And I think because some of the monks were ordering him around, he may not have been quick enough, they used to tweak his nose or bang him on the head. You know, just teasing the little novice boy. And then the Buddha saw that one day on Alms Round, and he gave a talk to the monks. And he said, listen up, monks. You don't know what you've been playing with. That novice not only is totally enlightened, but he's got immense psychic powers. A few days ago, he did a great battle with this dragon, this naga, who lived in this lake up in the Himalayas, and defeated this naga, even though he was only a small novice. He could whack you around all over the place, this little novice. Because he's got such great psychic powers. And that's when the Buddha, he gave the story of, was it the three or the four small things which are dangerous? Like a small snake. Even though it's a baby snake, It's still got lots of venom in it, so you don't play with baby snakes. You don't play with baby fires, because a small little fire, especially in the Australian bush, can become a huge bushfire. So be careful with even small fires. The third thing was a small prince. They may only be a baby, but if you upset them, they remember that when they become a king, they remember what you did to them, they got all the power, they'll really mess you around. And the last one, he said, is a small novice. Because you don't know, they may be totally and fully enlightened, and you're playing with immense power. So, there's many people in this retreat, who knows, they may be totally enlightened. And if you really are enlightened, you just don't know, they look quite ordinary. So be careful who you tell off, who you order around. There's the four things, small things will be done. So anyway, we don't really talk about that. One of the reasons we don't talk about who's in line and who's not in line, because it becomes what we call like an ego trip. And people start talking, you know, are you enlightened? You know, what did Ajahn Brahm say about you? You know, are you getting anywhere? And you say, no, nowhere. And you say, but I got somewhere. And that really sort of marks you. You really get fed up when that happens. So, you know, we don't sort of let people know. We just keep it quiet. We just disappear and just be ordinary or look ordinary. So there's no pride involved. When I sit down to meditate, it is like taking the MRT during peak hours. MRT is the train service in Singapore. Now, what do you mean like that? Like taking the MRT during peak hours. When I open my mind door, all the wandering thoughts start to appear and seem never ending. It's like all the people are making to get into the train. That's a very nice simile. I haven't heard that one before. How can I reduce the wandering thoughts? Okay, look. If you get into the train and you say, I've got a bomb, then everybody will leave your carriage. It'd be nice and peaceful. So you tell those wandering thoughts. How can you use that simile? I can use that simile. Just so the wandering thoughts know they've got nothing to do with you. Now really what's happening here is, I was going to say this morning, maybe I should have left this to tomorrow's talk, but the reason why wandering thoughts come into your mind is because you like the wandering thoughts. You're interested in them and you think they're important. If you realize they were rubbish, if you realize they had no value at all for you, they just weren't important, they would not remain in your head. So one of the great tricks to, not to get rid of the wandering thoughts, but just to allow them to disappear, is take away their value. And instead, value the silence. What is more important to you? Thinking out your philosophies, your problems, your plans, or being silent? Remind yourself what's the most valuable. And then you find that silence will remain. And the thoughts, you're just not interested in them anymore. They're rubbish, they're not important. In the same way, as I said, if you're watching the football and it's the last 5 minutes and it's 1-1 and you don't know who's going to win, then what your wife says is not important. Because what you're watching on TV is more valuable and that's what you pay attention to. Whatever is most valuable, that's what you pay attention to. When I was meditating as a young monk in Thailand, the story of all those mosquitoes crawling all over your head and your arm. If my mind wandered, it would go straight to the mosquitoes. But if my mind stayed with the breath, it got very still. You couldn't feel your arms anymore, your head. So you couldn't feel the mosquito bites. It was so important for me to watch the breath. It became very easy to do. My mind wouldn't wander at all. Because it was so important that it didn't wander. So if you put importance and value into the still mind, you find the thoughts don't come. The only reason your mind thinks a lot is because, honestly, you believe all that thinking is going to get you somewhere. You give it value. You give it meaning. Otherwise, you wouldn't think so much. So look at those thoughts and convince and brainwash yourself that they're mostly a waste of time and silence is more important for you. Then you can maintain the inner silence. Secondly, see if you can be more quiet and don't talk so much in other places during this retreat. Because if the mouth moves, the mind also moves. And you find if you can keep that external silence more, it's easier to stop the thinking. But when you go around talking about this and talking about that and chatting, your mind will also be moving. So it's a good time now to get more quiet on this retreat. You don't need to speak to people. And if someone comes and speaks to you, you don't need to say to them, be quiet, because then you've spoken. What you do when someone speaks to you, just get your finger and put it in front of your mouth and go, shh. That's all. And if there's anybody here who really has trouble, sort of with silence, and they can't stop speaking, come to myself or the two caretakers. In the workshop, we've got some masking tape. You can put it around your mouth, and we leave a little hole for a straw so you can have some breakfast. We'll mash it all up so it's liquid. And so you can drink but not talk. So try and keep quiet. Because it helps the inner silence as well. And then it's not like MRT anymore. It's just like total silence. What do the Buddha in the courtyard mudras say? In the courtyard? You mean just the two monks outside with their bowls? Is that what you mean? Or do you mean the Buddha's actually inside the stupas? Actually what they say is absolutely nothing. They're quiet. Yeah? The way the hands are. Yeah, just the way that... Yeah. There is all sorts of myths about what those different meanings are. And basically that's just a little bit of superstition. Because no one was there taking a photograph, you know, when the Buddha was teaching. And it's not described in the suttas of what happened when Mara came to him. Because they say that, you know, it's touching the earth. That's, you know, to witness, that the earth witness that he deserved to become enlightened. They have all these teaching. And I've never yet seen a monk, any teacher, put their hands in that position when they're giving a Dhamma discourse. So it's basically, it's a bit of a myth. I know I've seen in the walking posture, you can see the Buddha with his hands, sort of it's over his groin. They call that when there's a free kick in soccer, that's what you do in the wall. Posture. I think Ajahn Sara said that years ago. And you've also got this gesture. And of course that's to stop the traffic. So those are just like traditions. So don't take them so seriously. They're not really important. Does an empty stomach facilitate an empty still mind? Try it. And actually it does. Now, simply because physiologically, that just after you've eaten, you know, all the blood goes to your tummy, so it has to digest all the food, and means you've got less blood in your brain. So you do get always, you know, just less awareness after a full meal. It's common standard. So that's why after a full meal, if you don't take a rest, do some walking meditation. If you start sitting after a full meal, and if you come in here just after the lunch time, don't know how many people will be snoring or be nodding, because it's nothing to do with it, it's just nature. So do some walking after the meal rather than trying to sit, especially when it's hot. That's why we never go to conferences. You know, sometimes they put me deliberately on the after the meal, after lunch session. So I can tell a few jokes to keep people awake, because other people, they give a talk and no one listens because they've just had a big meal. All the blood goes to their tummy and they just half fall asleep. So this is just nature. So on an empty stomach, it's much easier. So that's why, you know, monks, we just eat in the morning. And in the afternoon, it used to be when I was in Thailand, about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon used to be the very best time to meditate. Because, you know, you digested the food, the energy was there in your blood. And, you know, the blood didn't have to do anything in the stomach. So it was up in the brain where it could actually be alert and wise. But if you really have no food and you're very weak, of course, and then you can't meditate very well. So you've got just the right amount of food. And then you find that, you know, you have energy and alertness. So yes, that's what you can do. So an empty stomach facilitates an empty still mind. So very easy. And for those of you who are a bit chubby like me, I learned something from science when I read an article about this. Actually, it answered one of these questions. Why is it that, you know, like fat people are always happy and jolly? Have you ever noticed that? You know, that people who, you know, are a bit overweight are always happy and jolly, you know, just like me. Now, this is important. If you are overweight, you have to be happy. You have to be jolly. Because what happens, I read in the science, that when you are happy, when you do laugh, actually your arteries actually expand. And when you get miserable and grumpy, they actually contract. So if you're overweight and grumpy, it's like a double whammy. You know, you've got small arteries and lots of cholesterol, you just can't make it through. And that's why you sort of die. So all the fat, miserable people, just they died a long time ago. It's evolution. So the only way to survive is if you are overweight, you have to be happy. So whatever extra cholesterol you have is overcome by the wide arteries you have because you laugh a lot. See, that's science. So anyway, that's what one needs to do. So an empty stomach is best for meditation. But not so you feel weak. How does one reconcile by being good enough and achieving excellence? That's the most excellent thing you can have, being good enough. That's how you achieve excellence. If you try chasing excellence, you never catch it. It's always in front of you. Have you ever, when you were a kid, tried to chase the rainbow? I was told there was a pot of gold at the end of that rainbow. So I saw the rainbow. You can actually see where it was hitting the ground. So you chased after it. And when I chased after it, the rainbow moved. And I chased faster, and the rainbow moved. I thought I could go faster than the rainbow and catch that pot of gold. However fast I moved, the rainbow was always out of reach. And for many people, that's called the pursuit of excellence. The pursuit of what you think is happiness. You know, sometimes in life it's almost in reach. You meet the perfect guy. You get the great job. And now it's almost there. And then something goes wrong. Isn't that the story of your life? And everybody's life. Chasing that rainbow. So that pursuit of excellence, after a while you think, is a pursuit which has no end. Excellence is promised. Just try a bit harder. Run a bit faster. Strive a bit more. Sleep a bit less. Spend more time at work. Get more qualifications. It's almost within reach. You ask people who followed that for a long time. They never get it. But you hear this monk who doesn't do anything, just sits around telling jokes all day when he's not sitting around meditating. Now this is excellence. The excellence of a happy, peaceful, blissful mind. Isn't that excellent? When you say excel, it means it goes beyond the ordinary. So what really excellence is peace, contentment, happiness, enlightenment. Is the most excellent quality of all. So if you want to pursue enlightenment, good enough is the path. This is the pursuit of excellence. Because here you can reach it. Out there in the world, you never can. You know, great artists, you know, people like Michelangelo, I think when he died, he was so disappointed because he got so close to excellence, but thought he hadn't reached it. I read somewhere he actually made an apology for not being good enough. That's what it's like being a great artist. A sports person, they almost become great, but not quite. In Australia, which loves cricket, we have this story, it's a legend which every Australian should know. Apparently they ask this question in tests for citizenship. What was the average of the great cricketer Don Bradman? The batting average. It's just to get rid of people the Australians didn't want, because not everybody likes cricket. And it was 99.94. He got so close to getting the 100 as his average over his career. No one else had done that. 99.94. Only a few more runs and he'd got it. He didn't quite make it. That's why the pursuit of excellence. You almost get there, but not quite. People tell me that all supermodels, these beautiful women you see on the front of magazines, they've all got pimples. That's why we need airbrushing. No one is perfect. So the pursuit of excellence never works. What's this? Oh, that joke. It's a great story. There was this really handsome guy. And, you know, he had a PhD. And he was drop-dead gorgeous. His father was a billionaire. So he had enough money. And he thought, wow, I'm the perfect guy. A great person. So I really want to marry the most perfect girl. So what he did? He's from Kuala Lumpur. He looked at all the girls in Kuala Lumpur to try and find the most perfect girl. And he saw this girl. I mean, she was very, very beautiful. But he couldn't marry her. She couldn't cook. So he moved to Singapore. And there he found a girl who was even more beautiful than the girl he saw in Kuala Lumpur. And cooking, she had her own restaurant. She was a chef. But he couldn't marry her either. Why? Because she was stupid. So then he moved to Perth. And there he found the most beautiful girl he'd ever seen. And she wasn't just a chef. She owned 5 restaurants. She was Michelin 5-star chef. And she was so intelligent. She had 3 or 4 degrees. One from Cambridge, one from Harvard, one from Berkeley. Oh, MIT as well. Someone from MIT, was she? Over there. She was absolutely a genius. But he couldn't marry her either. She was the most perfect girl, but he couldn't marry her. You know why? Because she was looking for the perfect guy. So you're not perfect, so you're not going to marry someone who's perfect. So that pursuit of excellence is endless. And sooner or later you'll find that. So instead, the pursuit of contentment, which is what you really wanted all along. Just a partner to be with, not the best, not the most beautiful, not the richest, but someone you can be content with and be happy together. Just a job, not the best, but something, you know, you can enjoy going to work in the morning. You know, you push yourself a little bit, you get enough money. Not the best, but good enough. And you're happy. You know, the kids at school, they don't do the best. They don't come to the top. As I've said in Singapore many times, if your child comes in the top 5% at school, or the bottom 5%, they're not good Buddhists. Buddhists believe in the middle way. If they come around the middle, they're good boys. So you can take content with them. Just like your meditation. If you want it to be better, it's not excellent anymore. If you're content with it, you understand what excellence truly is. So that's why good enough is the path to excellence. Can meditation be done with open eyes? If yes, how? Just open eyes. But then you say, what do you look at? And this is the problem. When your eyes are open, you're looking at this person and that person, what they're doing, what Ajahn Brahm's doing, you know, counting the bricks in the wall, looking at the floor. So sometimes when you've got your eyes open, it's just too much interference, too much agitation. That's why it's better to close the eyes. It can be done, but it's difficult. So it's better to close your eyes. Why people meditate in cemetery? Now, when I was wandering in Thailand, after 5 years you have the opportunity just to leave the monastery, just wander wherever you want to go. And now, any village you go to, you get your food in the morning, you had total freedom. And I remember Ajahn Chah said, look, if you want a quiet evening, ask the village where the cemetery is and go and sleep there at night and meditate there at night. No one will disturb you. And it was true because, you know, Thai people, same as Singaporeans, you're just so paranoid about ghosts, so scared about ghosts. And so that's why, as a monk, we go to where they thought the ghosts were. There are no ghosts there. But they didn't know that. I knew that. Ajahn Chah knew that. And what it meant, we could have some peace and quiet. So I had wonderful times in these cemeteries. You go there, and the people want to come and bother you and ask for lottery numbers and all this other stuff. But I was in the cemetery, so they didn't dare go in. So they left me alone. I had peace and solitude. It's a wonderful place to go to. So that's why I love cemeteries. They're so quiet and peaceful. And there ain't no ghosts around. If there are any ghosts coming, just get lost. Go. Because the ghosts, they are lower beings. You're higher beings. And it really surprised me. Why is it that people are afraid of ghosts when you've got far more power than any ghost? And I got this simile that elephants are afraid of mice, so they say. These tiny mice make the elephants paranoid. And it's only a tiny mouse, the elephant can squash it so easily. But it's afraid, just like you human beings are so afraid of these tiny ghosts, tiny in their power. You can squash the ghost very easy. So next time you see a ghost, exert your power. Say, ghost, get out of here, otherwise I'm going to give you some trouble. And the ghost has to go, you're much more powerful. And I know that, because I know that, actually ghosts are scared of me. You know, when I, many years ago, seeing ghosts, actually ran away from monks. They were scared. Ah, a monk can see us! Ah! So that's actually what happens, so that's great to meditate in the cemetery. I understand it has positive vibes there. Positive vibes? It's just peaceful vibes. The reason is because all those corpses there, they're meditating all the time, they're just laying down, doing nothing. Is it advisable to meditate in the plane? Yeah, it's great to meditate in aircraft. I remember when I've done that a few times, you know, you actually don't get jet lag if you meditate a long time because it's just so peaceful and quiet. And that's very, very nice. So it's great to meditate in a plane. The Ajahn Brahm, is the Dharma monk privilege only open to Aussie followers? Yes. It should be open to Aussie followers. If I say yes, you'd be putting it in your newsletter, in the BF newsletter. Any problems, please dial 95252420. No, come on, give me a break. Because I know a lot of time, if it's an emergency, yes. But sometimes that people, they spend half an hour talking about problems over the phone. And look, really, you need a proper counsellor. You know, just go and sort of see some counsellors, you know, in your home state. If it's a marriage problem, Look, why do you talk about marriages to a monk? You know, I've never been married. What would I know? I just make it up as I go along. So, you know, get an expert. I remember my record was 4 hours on the telephone once. It was this crazy lady. And I actually did this because I thought, I'm going to just test myself how long I could actually, you know, listen to this crazy lady. And so, you know, she was doing 99% of the talking. She'd be going on and on and on about her problems. And they say, are you listening? Yes. And then she'd go on for another 10 or 15 minutes. Are you listening? Yes. And that's all I ever said about, you know, yes, every 10 or 15 minutes. She was going on. 4 hours she did that. That's crazy. Actually, she worked for the Australian government. I found out afterwards, actually, the taxpayers paid that telephone call. That was really bad, but anyway. Did she say? No, not at all. No, those sorts of people, they just keep on. See how much they can squeeze out of you. It's true. And that's what you do in Singapore. And that's what you do in Malaysia. I remember actually hearing that once. I went to a talk. It wasn't in Singapore. It was here in Perth. And then I overheard these people, because I think I went to the toilet and I was coming out, and they didn't know I was right behind them. And said, are we going to try and get as much out of this monk as we possibly can tonight? Total exploitation. There it is, a man. So yeah, Dharma monk privilege is, actually I thought of actually, you know, they have in Singapore and modern countries, they have this, you know, press button service. You know, I thought of actually putting that on our monastery. We have it at our city centre. So, you know, if you want some chanting, if you want a prayer, press one. So, you know, you can get sort of no chanting, because that's what most people want. And if you want to speak to Ajahn Brahm, you haven't got a prayer. So press one anyway. I got that from a cartoon. In a mind-made world, if a person has no guilt for whatever wrongdoing he has done, does it mean the karma does not get realized? Yeah, you get beyond your old karma. There's a word in Pali, we call it ahosi karma. It means that karma that was, it's like latent, but you've just moved so far away it can't reach you anymore. It's like your record has been wiped clean. And it's, you can do that. It's a great thing to understand that all that karma you've done, you've done so much karma, so much good karma, so much bad karma of all your lifetimes. You know, you'll never be able to pay off all the bad karma you guys have done. Never. And you'll never be able to exhaust all the good karma you've stored up either. So you've got these huge stores, but because we're stupid, we actually go looking for the bad karma. We're negative, fault-finding. We remember all the bad things we did, all the bad things other people did. And when you realize that that's not a wise way to use your mind, instead, remember all the good karma you've done. If you really get down in this retreat, frustrated, fed up, start thinking of all the beautiful merit you've made in your life. Looking after monks, some great monks, serving them breakfast. Upal, you're the breakfast man over in the BF. Imagine just how much good karma you've done. If you can only remember that and just make use of it, I mean, you get jhanas easy. Remember all the great stuff you've done. Charity, kindness, service, looking after other people. Because the way karma works, you know, if you plant one seed, you get this huge tree with thousands of mangoes. And every one of those mangoes creates another tree, which is millions of mangoes. So one kind act, it's not just, you know, one for one. You know, you get sort of multiplied 1,000 times, 100,000 times, one good act. So you've all done amazing good karma. But you just don't know how to use it. So how do you make use and ripen the good karma? By remembering it, dwelling on it, and allowing yourself to be inspired. That this is an insight which came some years ago. I've told the story in the BF, but it's a great story. 2006, I was awarded this medal at Curtin University. Or 2004. Sometime, anyway, a few years ago. So I had to go to a ceremony to receive this medal for community service, leadership and vision in the Perth community. And so I had to give an acceptance speech. So what did I say? I say, I thank you very much for this honour of getting this medal. But I wouldn't have been able to do this without the help of all my friends and supporters. It's not just me, it's for everybody. And also, there are other people in the community who work much harder than I do much more service. They deserve it much more than me, but thank you anyway. And the next year I went to another ceremony where someone else was given a medal. And I listened to their speech. And they said, I wouldn't be able to get this award without the help of all the other people supporting me. And there's other people in the community who deserve it much more than me. And I thought, I remember that speech. That was my speech last year. And it's usually the speech of everybody who gets an award. And I thought, because that fellow who got the award after me, he was an inspiring man. He did a great service. And as I was listening to what he did, I thought, my goodness, that guy deserved that. And so I started looking back at what I had done. And after all, I thought, actually, I did deserve that medal. I did do a lot of work. Why was it that I couldn't accept the praise? Why was it I was deflecting it and saying, well, other people deserve it more than me, and I couldn't do it by myself? This whole panel had investigated what I've done, and they come to the conclusion I deserve this medal. So now I've made this resolution, next time I get any award or medal, when I give my speech, I say, thank you, I deserve it. Why are you laughing? I mean, these people, they're not idiots. They research it. They think you deserve it. And you're saying you don't. So what I'm doing, I'm acknowledging the panel. Yeah, they were right. I deserve it. Thank you. Why is it we don't accept good karma? We just push it away. That's why we don't make use of good karma. You've done something wonderful. You get praise, or you try and praise yourself, and you just push it aside. So when you think of what you've done, you're marvellous. You deserve that praise. You deserve the good karma. Well done. Take it on board. Dwell on it. Cherish it. And when you cherish all the good things you've done rather than pushing it aside, you know how to make use of the good karma you've done. It makes you happier, healthier, and much closer to enlightenment. Which is why even the Buddha said, if you're meditating you feel a bit dull, reflect on all the good karma you've done so far, especially recently. Dwell upon it. And remember just what an amazing thing you've done, until it brings tears to your eyes. And then start meditating. And then it's so simple to get into deep meditation. If Mother Teresa thinks she has not done enough, does it mean she gets bad karma for the guilt she has? And the guilt is not actually so much bad karma. Guilt is just, you know, trying to bring up the bad karma and ignoring the good karma. So if you're going to sort of use your accumulated wealth, and start dipping into the good karma bank account. And you've got plenty of money in there. Make use of it. Reflect on all the wonderful things you've done. When someone does praise you, when your wife says, oh, thank you, darling, say, yes, I deserve that. And don't just push it aside. After 3 days, I still cannot sit still. What should I do or not do? Okay, sit in a chair, and we've got some handcuffs and some restraints. We have a straight jacket, so we can make you sit still. No, don't worry, don't try to sit still. that makes you agitated. Just let go of all of the things which make you move. Here we go, this is one of those exercises. Mike, you've done this before, but please play along. I'm now going to keep this bottle of water perfectly still. Has it stopped moving yet, Mike? So what should I do? After 3 days, not so quick. After 3 days, I've been trying to hold this water perfectly still. And is it still? No. Because you try and hold your mind still, it never becomes still. So as Mike said, you just put it down. Now, as I'm putting it down, Mike, what happens to the water? It moves more than normal. So when you start letting go, actually the mind becomes a bit more agitated. It has more sloth and torpor. It has more thoughts. That's okay, that's par for the course, but don't go picking up again. Let it go. It's good enough. Stop wanting it to be different. Stop holding things. Now, what's that water like? Uh-oh. Must be an earthquake. Give it a few more seconds and it'll be perfectly still. Because that's the nature of the water. It's slightly trembling, but I couldn't hold it that still. And that's the nature of things when you let them go. So if you haven't been still yet, it's because you've been trying to be still. You've been working too hard. You've been striving. So just sit down and see if you can learn just to let things be. So this controller inside of you, notice this controller always judging, trying to make it this way, trying to make it that way. Notice that being and just let that one go. Let the controller go, the doer. That thing inside of you which is always planning and making things happen. Once that disappears, the water becomes still. Now it's still. Just 1 minute, 2 minutes, that's what it takes. Anyway, my teenage daughter was invited by friends to go to church. She witnessed a speaking tongue, so was told it's a God's words. Well, God's, if that's God's words, he speaks gobbledygook, because no one understands it. I'm not sure what that phenomenon is as well. Is this considered possessed by what? It is a possession, possessed by stupidity. Look, now just being quite frank, people are so stupid. I mean, if it was really possessed by tongues, if you can go to a church and speak perfect Greek or perfect Swahili, then that would be impressive. But they just speak, anyone could do that. Ajahn Brahm speaks in tongues, hallelujah! Now you don't want to put down real Christianity, but that is not real Christianity, that is actually stupid stuff. So be very careful. I remember, Angie, she told me this story. There was one of the BF members. Her son had a hearing disability. It wasn't deaf. Just partially deaf. And like any mother would love her child so much, she'd go anywhere, if they could, get the child's hearing back together again. So she went on one of these, I think the Rock or something it's called, and then it was her turn, and it came on, and she's, the pastor said, and here we have a boy who's deaf. And before the mother said, he's not deaf, he's just got a disability. The pastor shouted in his ear, can you hear me? Can you hear me? Right in the ear. He said, yes. A miracle! Hallelujah! Now actually that happened. And before, so the mother could say, look, anyone can do it. They could do that before. He's not deaf, he's got hearing disability. But the point was that people were there wanting miracles, wanting something. So, ordinary things became miracles. Now that actually, you know, it happens to many people. This is one of Ajahn Chah's stories. In the very early years of his monastery, Wat Pa Phong, it was on a full moon night. I think it was actually on the Pawarana day, which is what we just had, the last full moon day. And that's when many people, you know, they come to listen to a sermon, but the monks have to do their ceremony first of all. That wasn't it. I think it was the entry to the rain stay, because they were doing the Patimokkha recitation, which takes about 40-50 minutes. And this was the early days that it was raining, pouring down with rain. And this car from town got stuck on the entrance road into the monastery. Got bogged. And the rain was pouring down, you know, monsoon time. And these people in the car didn't know what to do. And they saw out of the forest came Ajahn Chah and helped push the car. Even though he got mud on his robe, got a soaking, pushed the car out of the mud so they could go and listen to the talk. And they thought, now that's a compassionate monk. It doesn't matter how famous you are, you know, you're willing to get yourself wet and dirty to help good people. And then, you know, after getting bogged, you know, it's only 5 minutes from there to the hall, they got to the hall and they couldn't believe their eyes. There was Ajahn Chah sitting in the hall, dry as a bone. And they thought, a miracle! It's a miracle! Ajahn Chah, he was listening to this recitation and he must have seen we were in trouble. And he sent his astral body or somebody out to help our car and push it out. It's a miracle, psychic powers. And they went all around town. Ajahn Chah has a cousin who was a novice. He's called Ajahn Paitun. I know him very well. It was him! He was a novice, so he wasn't actually in the Patimokkha meeting. And he saw the car, and he's a kind monk, and he pushed it. Now this was dark in the rain. Your cousin, you know, he's got some similarity in the features. And so once he heard this rumour was going around, he said, no, it was me. You know, it wasn't Ajahn Chah, it was me. But no, everyone wanted a miracle. And so to this day, that miracle stands. Even Ajahn Paitun said, it wasn't Ajahn Chah, it was me. Because people want miracles. And I'm sure there's many people going around saying, I've done miracles. No! It's just somebody else who looks like me. We want miracles very much. And so, this is what happens when, you know, when people go to these things. Your daughter goes to church, she witnesses speaking tongues, and it's just gobbledygook. But when people really want a miracle, even gobbledygook, they say it's a miracle. So the gullibility of people knows no bounds. I still remember sort of the great philosopher Voltaire. One of my favourite quotes from him, the French philosopher, playwright Voltaire. He said, the only way to understand the mathematical concept of infinity is to contemplate the extent of human stupidity. Because people believe in anything. And sometimes they just suspend their reason because they just want to believe. So that's why in Buddhism, in the BF, ask those questions, investigate, be skeptical, doubt, follow science. And don't just believe blindly in these things. There are some magical things happen. But you know, speaking in tongues is not one of them. It's just gobbledygook. You just saw me do it. It's recorded. You can play it to them. Ajahn Brahm, he can speak in tongues too. Do people become arahat even today? I'm not sure today. A few days ago, maybe. There's still a few hours left. Is it possible for family man and woman to become an arahat? Yes, you too can become an arahat, but there's a cost to pay. If you become an arahat on this retreat, you won't be able to go back to Singapore in your lay clothes. You have to become a monk or a nun within 7 days or you will die. So I say, okay, I won't be an arahat. Now, the reason is, and this is actually, it's in the commentaries, but it actually makes a lot of sense to me. Because once you're totally enlightened, you've got just no desires and cravings for the world at all. You can't go back there anymore. It's just, It's just ridiculous. It's stupid. You just won't be able to do it. So become a monk or a nun so you can teach and live, not just teach with words, but teach by example, being a renunciant. Basically, you just don't fit anymore. And you know, you feel that. You know that sometimes you're in a place, a job, and you realize this is not you. You don't fit there anymore. You don't belong. It's very, very uncomfortable. You multiply that by 1,000 times and you understand one arahat just, you know, can't go back home. Next question. Oh, this is a very good question. Are good looks bad karma? It must be difficult for movie stars to quiet down and practice Dharma. Really not my business, but I'm just curious. That's a very good question. You're very perceptive, and the answer is yes. Average looks is the best karma. Really beautiful looks is bad karma. And just, you know, the reason is, I mean, just because of your look, you get bothered by so many men. And if you're a beautiful woman, and they just see your face, or they see your figure, and that's all they see. And you don't marry, you know, a set of breasts. You marry a person. You've got to live with that person. So it's really important to see the person. And so a lot of times, like, very beautiful women just, you know, get quite upset at their beauty. Famous people, you know, just get... There's one of the friends who was a monk with me, and he said that one day he was in Los Angeles. And actually first thing, who was that, the great film director, Dirty Harry, what's his name? Clint Eastwood, that's right. Clint Eastwood was just starting out. And he was on the same sort of fraternity, and they have these fraternity houses, Alpha, Beta, Pi, or whatever. And he was holding this party, and so he went to the fraternity house, you know, to get some ushers for the party, and he was one of them. So he got to this elite party with all these famous people like Clint Eastwood, and later on he managed to squeeze into a hotel where Bob Dylan was staying. So he spent the evening with Bob Dylan. And he said one of the things he'd always remember this guy Bob Dylan saying, he said, it's hell being famous. And he meant it. You can't do anything. That I'm not famous, but I'm well known. And you know my story, I was in the United States, you know, doing a Dharma teaching tour, and people are asking me all these questions, and in the end you do get tired out. And people come up and say, one more question. One more question. I don't know how many times I've heard that. One more question. There's always another part to it. So I was really tired. And then, you know, they finally get on the aircraft, and you try and get asleep, but I don't sleep well on the aircraft. And you landed in Singapore, just transiting. And there's plenty of people working in SIA that they actually, you know, on the air side. So they met me at the gate. And of course, straight away, they're asking questions on meditation, on Dharma. They took me to the lounge, and they were just still asking me questions. It's very hard to say, now leave me alone. Please can be quiet. So I didn't dare say that. So I thought, how can I escape from these people? And I said, I need to go to the toilet. And my plan was to get on a toilet seat and just sit there for 10 or 15 minutes, get some peace and quiet. But as soon as I got into the toilet, this toilet in Changi Airport, every toilet has an attendant, as you know. The attendant looked at me and said, are you Ajahn Brahm? Can I ask you a question? So even in the toilet I can't escape. But I'm on the Ajahn Brahm. Imagine what it's been like, Clint Eastwood or Michael Jackson or whatever, you know. Actually, he's dead now, isn't he? At last he's got some peace. So good looks and fame is bad karma. So if you're not the most beautiful woman in the whole of Singapore, well done, you're so lucky. If you're not the most handsome, popular man, well done, you can have some peace. So, you know, it must be terrible being a prisoner of a beautiful face. Dear Ajahn, during meditation I sometimes feel a slight sensation around the area in the middle of my forehead. Should I ignore it and continue to focus on the breath? Yeah, it's probably only a fly. There's lots of flies around. Yeah, just ignore it. Although I am determined to get liberated, I think somebody thinks it's the third eye. It's not the third eye, it's just a fly. Although I'm determined to get liberated in this life, but I need to have plan B just in case I do not succeed. Plans, plans, plans. No way will you succeed if you've got too many plans. Last night you said we create our own heaven. I don't want to have a rebirth because everything in this world bored me to tears. You think this life is boring? Imagine heaven. You can't misbehave at all. There's so many goody-goodies up there. It must be very boring. All you ever eat, well, that's what I was told, you eat this ambrosia. Morning, evening, daytime, every day for a century. You don't have any decent music, it's always harps. You can't wear fashion, it's always white clothes draping around you. It must be so boring up there. So I don't want... That's actually the Christian idea of heaven. I must admit, Valhalla, I was saying the other day, it must be a bit more interesting, just drinking, fighting and eating. But even after a few centuries of that, you get bored. I think there was, I confess, I did watch one movie once called Groundhog Day. And the reason was that I went over to Sri Lanka, it was years ago, and the guy I went with, who was my attendant there, was raving about this Groundhog Day. So it's a great movie, it's a really Buddhist movie. And as it just happened, on the flight back, they were actually playing that, so I asked for the headphones and looked at it. And you know the Groundhog Day? You know, this guy repeats the day again and again and again and again until he's bored out of his skull. He tries to commit suicide. He does kill himself, but he's bored that morning again. He just can't get out of this cycle. That's why it was so similar to samsara. Always getting reborn. And after a while, haven't you had enough of it yet? You want to get out? Unfortunately, being Hollywood, he fell in love. And then he was born the following day, he got out of the cycle. That sucked. That's not how you get out of samsara, by falling in love with a member of the opposite sex. That's more boring. You know, you ask people who've married long enough. I only want to practice this answer. Please help me build such a heaven for my next rebirth. Yeah, okay, if you really want to do that, build the next heaven for your rebirth, come and see me afterwards, I'll shave your hair, I'll put on some brown robes. That's the best heaven. The monk heaven, the nun heaven. I don't know actually why not more people want to become monks and nuns. It's a beautiful life. See, I'm having a good time. I'm a good ambassador for being a monk and a nun. There's no worries, at peace, no husband, no wife, no kids, no tax. You know, no to worry about your finances. Oh, it's beautiful. You just spend your evenings telling jokes to your friends. Great time. So that's how you can get liberated. So your plan A is to become a monk. Plan B is to become a monk. You mentioned about just enough this morning. It is easier to practice that attitude in this retreat than compared to outside life. How do I incorporate that in my daily living without being a doormat? Do you know ducks quack? Ducks quack don't echo. That's interesting. I never knew that quacks don't echo. Is that true? Can we get your rabbit to imitate a duck so we can test it out? I know the story of the two ducks. Two ducks swimming in a pond and one duck said quack. The other one said, damn it, I was going to say that. Silly joke, isn't it? But anyway, just enough or good enough was the actual word that is okay to do in the retreat. And a lot of time in your life as well, how much money do you need? Have you got enough yet? It's good enough. Your partner in life, you know, do you want to swap it for a better model? Or is he or she good enough? Your kids, you know, do you really want them to do so much better? Are they good enough? Can you open the door of your heart and love them for who they are? You're good enough for my love. You don't have to be better. You don't have to struggle and strive so much to please me. I love you for who you are. And little old me,
struggling and striving all my life to please myself, and I'm never good enough. So now, I'm going to be good enough. Good enough that I can be at peace with myself. That I can open the door of my heart to me. Come in. Come in me. I'm good enough. You try that. Wow. You take off. May I ask why are the chanting before the Q&A are in Pali while the Metta Sutra done in English? Why not? I don't know. It's nice to do some Pali. Sometimes the English translation is not as good. So we do some in Pali, some in English. So just to make, maybe do some in Chinese next time. Maybe people in Singapore. There's a few, some people from India would do some in... what language in Chennai is it? Is it Bengali? Hindi? Sorry? Tamil, in Tamil. So some in Tamil. There's, who else is here today? There's people from Thailand. Some in Thai. Some in Polish. Yeah, Gaelic. Some in Gaelic as well. Some in Norwegian. So look, we can't please everybody, so a little bit of Pali, a little bit of English is enough. Also, it seems the Metta Sutra chanting only has three notes in the whole melody. That's just because they made it that way. Maybe it's more than to create a better melody. I mean, Christian hymns have so much melody in them. Can we do the same? How can we do that? I actually didn't like the Christian chants, but if we made it more rock, that'd be really good. Or even blues. This is what should be done by one who is skillful. The blues. Anyway, no, come on. And why do people believe in God? And a lot of times it's because people are told and they're brought up and brainwashed that way. And then when you actually look around you, you say, where's the evidence? Are you guys all right? Now, people are like sheep, they follow other people, and they take the lazy option. And we look around, I mean, Creator God, science knows there's no need for a Creator God. Even Stephen Hawking came out recently saying, no way there's a Creator God, and a God which intervenes in human affairs. You know, where was he in the Hurricane Katrina? Where was he in the tsunami? Didn't help. And as many people say, he couldn't even help his own son. He got executed. I get into trouble for that, but I don't mind. Enough trouble already. So, do these Christians, non-Buddhists get reincarnated too when they die? Of course they do, everyone gets reincarnated. Finally, are dreams that one have during sleep similar to what one experiences in deep meditation? No. In deep meditation, there's no dreams. The one is perfectly clear. And so, you know, in some dream states, even in what they call lucid dreaming, still you're not in sort of total control. It's a bit of a haze. You're not really sure what's happening. But in meditation, it's perfect mindfulness. And also perfect joy as well. That's the other thing which is not there in dreams, just joy and happiness. Although that sometimes, I've done this, other people have done this, sometimes you're meditating and sometimes you're sleeping and just a nimitta comes up in your sleep and with it comes all the joy. There's so much happiness, you can't be asleep like that, you wake up straight away. So the joy in meditation is so strong, it just, you know where you can be asleep. Sorry for asking so many questions, but my mind keeps wandering and thinking when I'm not doing anything. Thanks, yeah, just restlessness. So, and then there's no more questions. When there's no more questions, there's no answers. Then you're at peace at last. So see if you can put more value to silence. That's where all the questions end. Did the Buddha give any specific instructions on metta like he did for breath meditation? Only a little bit, but not much. But basically, that people want so many instructions. And really, all you need to do is, it's a simple instruction. Some people, the Buddha gave them such a simple instruction, like just sit still and shut up. And they did it. And they became arahats. But these days, people need all these instructions and talks and talks and talks. So, keep it simple. Can you please request everyone not to make so much noise when they come in for the evening question and answer? Do you really make so much noise? I make more noise than anybody. All my talking. But no, no. Remember what Ajahn Chah said when we complained about the noise from the village. And they wouldn't listen to us. They wouldn't stop the noise for the Western monks. So we thought if we asked Ajahn Chah, the Thai villagers, they would follow his request and be quieter for us. So we went to see Ajahn Chah. Can you please tell these lay people not to make so much noise in the village at night? And he said to us the famous words, monks, it's not the noise disturbs you, it's you who disturb the noise. And that was one of those great sayings. And it's so true, it's not the noise of the people that disturbs you, you disturb the noise. Next you'll be asking me, can you please ask the magpies not to make so much noise? Can you please ask the refrigerator to be quieter? It's the nature of birds to make noise. It's the nature of dogs to bark. It's the nature of rabbits to go, ch-ch-ch, isn't it? Or quack-quack, one of the two. And it's the nature of human beings to make noise as well. So they can't be totally quiet. Neither can the person who asked that question. You can be more quiet though. But once there's a noise, please don't disturb it. It's just noise. Someone makes a noise. Bang! Who was that? Why did they make the noise? They shouldn't have made the noise. Now you're disturbing the noise. The bang disappeared a long time ago. But it's still reverberating in your mind. So as soon as the person finishes making the noise, don't allow the noise to echo in your memory, and then you don't disturb the noise. Dear Ajahn, quite often I weep during meditation. That's because it hurts so much. Or while eating lunch, I can't believe that doesn't hurt. On dana by others, here. I'm glad you don't say you weep when you hear my jokes. My bad jokes, sometimes I make people cry, they're so bad. Quite often I weep during meditation or while eating lunch on dana by others. Here, what are the causes and how does one overcome that? That's pity, you're getting happy. Don't overcome it. It's good for you, it's okay to cry, you're allowed to cry in this retreat. It's not against the 8 precepts, there's no rule on the board saying you shall not cry. You won't get thrown out from this retreat by crying. Cry! Enjoy it. Let it come. Because a lot of time it's pity when people bring dana. Where's all your food coming from? You know, some of it is brought, but a lot of it, people are actually cooking it for you. They're bringing, they're doing their very best. They're looking after you. They're serving you. As I said yesterday, the floor you're sitting on over here, the monks worked, what's the time to 2 or 3? You were doing as well, were you? What time? 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning before they finished. All day, all night. And sometimes I think, wow, the monks did this for me. And that gives you this great sense of joy and happiness. People bring all this food for you. You're not monks and nuns, but you're meditating and they really want to look after us and look after you as well. And brings joy to your heart. Ajahn Brahm, I don't need to spend all my time doing this. I've got a beautiful cave over there. So I think, oh, isn't it wonderful that people help and serve? It brings joy. Weep. And that brings this great sense of peace and happiness. And then meditate after the tears have not really totally dried, but when they've calmed down a little bit and you get into the very deep meditations. It feels all so nice. So was it inability to control our mind? You don't control your mind. No one can. It's just due to menopausal depression. No. No, it is just joy and happiness. Let it come, menopausal depression. Please tell a bit more about Jhana Grove Retreat Center. Was the land donated? By whom? My deepest gratitude. No, we purchased this land. So when we heard it was on sale, we looked how much it was,
we didn't have enough.
I think I remember someone sitting over there. I think we're $20,000 short. And they wrote out a check for $20,000. You know who I'm talking about? She'd be anonymous, but she's called Li Ming. You did that, remember? I think. Is that correct? Yeah, I think so, yeah. So well done. So this place is here because of people like you.
No, you should say I deserve that.
Very good. So this is how this place came. And then we sort of started building it. How are the running costs funded? Just by donations. That's why we don't charge for these retreats. Although the Buddhist fellowship, you know, they said you had to pay so much money. But if you couldn't afford it, you just come anyway. So for most retreats, we just say by donation. We tell people roughly how much it costs per day, but it's all done by donation. If you can't afford it, fine. So that's how the running costs are funded, and we still keep it very cheap here, and much of the two caretakers here, don't get a salary. So they do it as their generosity. They live here for free, and they eat the leftovers from everybody else. They actually do pretty well. But you know, they have joy doing it. So this is the beautiful Buddhist way of doing it. It's a center on surplus or deficit now. Now we've got some extra money, which is why we're building Teacher's Cottage next. Our more fund is needed for building more cottages and other facilities, landscaping. There's always money needed. But when the money comes, then we do more. When the money's not there, we just don't do anything. So it's a great way. We don't sort of go searching or cajoling people for money. We don't sort of have this donation box at the exit there, just rattling it. Have you seen the donation box? Many of you haven't even seen it. It's just in the corner of the kitchen, the tiny one. Not like in some of these monasteries and temples, you know, just turn around the corner and every corner there's a donation box. So, you know, we keep it nice and simple. Just make it easy for people to do, but just keep it simple and don't make it a big thing. So if you want to support, fine. If you can't, fine. And you're loved both ways. Ajahn Brahm, you talked about good enough this morning. How do we balance the teaching good enough in the fast-paced world of striving for excellence? Oh, I did this one. Where you're never good enough. Other people might not say you're good enough, but I will always say you're good enough. So you know there's one person in this world who thinks you're good enough. Hopefully there's two, your partner in life. That's really what a partner should be, a husband or wife. Someone who tells, darling, you're good enough. I love you for who you are. You don't have to be excellent. You know, it's just such a wonderful relief. This is some people who love you. Does good enough mean we have no drive or motivation? Well, it takes a lot of motivation to say good enough. You've been driving around so much, your poor car has run out of petrol, so stop. Park your car and say good enough. Ajahn Brahm, you could sit, meditate for more than 1.5 hours and still spring up from your seat and walk normally. Of course. Because this is actually a spring cushion over here. So it's because I've been meditating for a long time. And my knees and my legs are reasonably good. My back's good, you know, because I live a peaceful life. So I've got reasonably good health. So, you know, you do spring up. And it's fine. So, do you stretch yourself secretly afterwards? No, I never see you stretch. I'm used to this. This is my life. One of the problems is when you go on sort of the aircraft, you know, and Singapore Airlines, because, you know, the seats are so cramped, and you can't sit cross-legged. And so to me, that is painful when I have to dangle my legs over the seat. Sitting cross-legged is what I like the best. So sometimes you see me in the car. You know, if you go on a long journey into town, I sit cross-legged in the front seat of the car. Or, you know, in an aircraft, you know, the seat next to me is free, then cross-legged is much better. You can sit for hours like that. And I often thought that it would be wonderful if more people sat cross-legged on Singapore Airlines or Tiger Air or Thai Airways. It's a Buddhist airline. They should sit cross-legged. Then you can have like two levels, even in an ordinary aircraft. You'd be able to pack many more people in. They make more money that way. See? good idea for Tiger Airs. Cross-legged sitting, get half price. So, is the pain... Sorry, I feel all knotted up after meditation. Is a pain in my head? Is it unmeditated to stretch? Nobody here does it. Thank you. Am I indulging in body pleasure? I said, no, you can stretch. You can scratch. You can blow your nose. You can cough. It's not against the precepts. So you can stretch if you like, but it's just because I'm used to this. If your body feels knotted up sitting on the floor, then sit on the chairs. So you're comfortable when you're meditating. Not meditation quick. Not supposed to kill or harm anything. So how do I resolve the mixed feeling when killing pests, e.g. cockroaches, dengue carrying mosquitoes? Okay, well, you're not killing them, you just give them a new rebirth. Yes, you are killing them. That's what the Thai people used to tell me the first year I was in Thailand. You know, Thailand's a very practical country. The villages up in the northeast, they were supposed to be keeping five precepts. They were catching all these fish. And so when I told them, I said, look, you're breaking your precepts, you're killing the fish. I said, no, we're not. We're not killing them. We just take them out of the water and they die by themselves. That's Buddhist logic. So, don't kill the pests unless you really, really, really have to. So just explore all other options first of all. That's why when we built this place, we'd have as little wood as possible. You know, not structural timber. So cockroaches come in. Not cockroaches, some white ants, termites come in. You know, that they can't do much damage. So that's why we use bricks. All the roofs of steel, you know, not sort of wood. That wood over there and the ceiling over there, it's a special hardwood. The termites don't take it, same as the bamboo. They're not supposed to eat this stuff. So we try and keep everything so that we don't have to spray or to kill or whatever. So we do the best we possibly can. But, you know, sometimes it happens at home. Now there is an infestation, or there is some cockroaches, or whatever. So what you have to do is, you know, sometimes if you have to by law, you've got no choice. But next time, see if you can make your kitchen smaller and cleaner, so the cockroaches can't come in. See if you can get the fly screens on the windows, so the mosquitoes can't come in. So you don't have to worry about dengue fever. So there's many, many things you can do. Sometimes it costs more money. I remember the Chitthurst Monastery, in the first years they were there. They were taken over by rabbits, wild rabbits. And the rabbits would use the monastery for sanctuary, and at night time go into the neighbouring farms and eat all their crops. And so the neighbouring farms started complaining. Look, this was their livelihood. And the rabbits, these Buddhist rabbits in the monastery, were going out at night and scuttering back to their sanctuary to hide out from the farmers during the daytime. They had a really good thing going. And so the neighbouring farmers asked, can we eradicate your rabbits? And the monks thought, we can't allow that. But then we can't allow these rabbits to go and spoil the livelihood of our neighbours. So they got this wonderful solution. They got a rabbit fence. A rabbit fence, you have to dig it deep into the ground, because the rabbits will burrow under. So they spent a huge amount of money putting a rabbit fence around the monastery to keep the rabbits in. Usually you put rabbit fences to keep rabbits out. But this one was to keep them in. So that was many years ago, and people thought, you're being stupid, monks. The rabbits will just keep on multiplying and multiplying. And they haven't. They just kept their population there. And of course, they're so used to human beings now, they're quite happy coexisting with the humans, so they don't run away. So that's the way they solve the problem. It costs them a lot of money. It's very, very, very commendable. It's worth spending the money to save animals' lives. So if you possibly can, find innovative solutions. How do we resolve mixed feelings when eating meat, killed animals? I still eat meat. The fixed feelings is that, remember, monks, we have to eat whatever we're given. And sometimes you have a choice, sometimes you don't have a choice. So if you have a choice, maybe try to be a vegetarian. But some people just can't do that for one reason or another. So if you have to eat meat, don't waste any. An animal's given its life for you. So make sure you use that protein for good purposes. Do good, don't do bad things. Unfortunately, even when we eat carrots, the fields have been sprayed properly, probably. The land has been dug. Many animals have been killed just to plant a row of carrots. So you don't get anything in this life for free. Even transporting the rice from one place to another, so many animals get squashed on the windscreen. Everything costs life. Which means when you eat your breakfast or your lunch, remember there's many sacrifices for that one slice of bread. So don't waste it. And that's a nice thing to remember. Is faith critical in Buddhism? Will there be times in the practice that we need a leap of faith? Faith is very dangerous. Sometimes you have faith in the wrong things. Who do you have to believe? Because even monks say different things. So, faith based on wisdom. So don't just have a leap of faith. Look what you're leaping into, first of all. So use a bit of wisdom. Because sometimes too much faith leads people into very, very difficult situations. Was Buddha a vegetarian when he became enlightened? What's your view on Buddhism and vegetarian? It's very clear he was not. There's many stories about him eating meat. So I've always said about vegetarian, you try and be as harmless as you possibly can. But you can't be perfect. Good enough. It is said there were 28 fully enlightened Buddhas before Siddhartha Gautama, and that the time span between each is many eons. However, Homo sapiens have only been in existence for around 200,000 years. How can we explain the existence of so many Buddhas when humans have not evolved so long ago? This is the present batch of human beings. There are other human beings or other similar beings in previous eons. If it happened, was it 200,000 years ago? In this one planet? Couldn't it have happened in other planets? Couldn't it have happened even now, in other planets, in other solar systems, elsewhere in the universe? Do you believe in aliens? You don't. There must be aliens. Because when I went to Heathrow Airport once, there was a whole line which said aliens this way and EU citizens another way. I had a British part, I was an EU citizen, so I was okay. I was waiting to see these people with antennas and bulgy eyes go through the alien station. So certainly the British government believes there's aliens. Has anyone seen a UFO? A flying saucer? No, yeah. Very strange things up in the sky. And Bob hadn't seen a UFO. Were you abducted? Oh, that's boring. Actually, there's one of my friends. He's a monk in Sydney. Harry, his name is. Venerable Harry. He's with Chalkun Mahasamaya. He wrote a book, From Balmain to Buddha. He's this really down-to-earth, Ocker Aussie monk. Balmain was the port city of Sydney. It was really as rough as guts there. He opened his book with a wonderful line. He said, in Balmain, if you still have your front teeth by 3 years of age, you're a girl. In other words, they were always fighting each other. Then eventually, he was a merchant seaman. And towards the end of his life, he became a monk. And a Theravada monk, over in Sydney with Chalkun Mahasamaya. Now, because he's a monk, he's absolutely honest. And he says that one of the things which happened when he was a seaman, he said in all places,
He was in the Bermuda Triangle. He said he's absolutely honest. He was on watch at night on one of these merchant ships, and he saw this thing in the distance, this light. He asked the first mate, who was also on watch, and they saw this light in the distance on the horizon. And he said in a second or two, it came right over their ship and bathed them in green light. He said the first mate went to wake the captain up. He was just watching this really weird. And by the time the captain sort of got out of his pajamas and onto deck, it had gone. They both saw it. Now that's someone I could trust. Who knows? Maybe tonight. It's weird, I don't know, I've never seen anything. But who knows? But certainly, ask any scientists and the possibilities are just not possibilities, it's quite likely. There's other sentient life in other places. And reading through the old Buddhist suttas, there is one sutta which says, yes, there are other worlds with other beings similar to us. It's in Anguttara Nikaya. So, the answer to the question. This is not the first time there's been people like human beings in this universe. It won't be the last time. Many universe cycles. Many sort of species of humans. This is our current one, the one we remember. The ones which came before. In other planets, in other times. Who knows? I kind of like that idea. Because it's vast expanse of life. Not just this one universe, but multiple universes. That's really cool. Anyway, back to this universe. When you are in deep meditation, is there a need for a proper slow exit? Can one just wait a deep meditation in any way? When meditators sense danger, is there a way for emergency exit? Number one is no danger. So you don't have to worry that someone's going to harm or hurt you. In deep meditation, you are invulnerable. In the suttas, there was a case of this monk. He was meditating in the jungle. And he was so still, so peaceful, he wasn't moving at all. And his two Buddhist villagers passed by him and thought, my goodness, the monk has died. Because they were Buddhists, they thought, it's not right to leave a dead monk to be eaten by the jungle animals. We have to give him a proper funeral. So they collected some wood, they were in the jungle. It didn't take them long to make a pyre. And they put the monk on top. And they lit the fire. And once the fire was established and flames were going everywhere, they thought, well, the fire will look after it now. Now we've got other things to do. So they left the monk to be cremated. And imagine what they felt the following morning when they saw the monk come in to their village on arms round. Not even his robe was charred. Which shows that when you get into deep meditation, even if they cremate you, you just don't burn. Not even your clothes burn. It's one of the powers of meditation. And there's a monk I used to know, he was an Indonesian monk. But he had psychic powers, he was a very powerful monk. And he told me his story. Before he became a monk, he went into the jungles of Java, to meditate. And it's fascinating, the story he told me. He said he was meditating, he saw this light. He said it was like a deva coming to him. That's how he described it, but it was a nimitta. Came to him and it just that pure love. He went into this very deep state. He said when he came out afterwards, many days had passed. Not hours. He'd been sitting so still for such a long time. Just in bliss. And he noticed, because he was in the jungle, there were marks on the trees, as if there had been a flood. And he asked the village, and there had been a flood. And he realized he had been submerged in water many meters deep, for don't know how long. Didn't know a thing. Perfectly safe. So when you go in these deep meditations, you are like invulnerable. You don't need an emergency exit. Just wait for the flood to pass. Wait for fire to burn out, and then you can walk away. Simple.
But for an exit strategy, it is true, if you go into really deep meditation, you can't walk fast. You know, you can't do anything fast. So if you see your friend or your partner just coming out of a deep meditation, look after them. Don't just say, hey, how about a cup of coffee? That would be just grating, because as Ajahn Chah used to call it, like pouring hot water into a cold glass. Sometimes the glass shatters. So just allow the glass to warm up slowly. Talk to them gently. Let them move slowly. And they'll come out. But they don't come out quickly. You think they're crazy, they're mad. They're not mad, they're just so still, so peaceful. It just takes a while to get themselves warmed up again. So the proper exit is just natural, just go slowly. How to help a friend who is full of negative thoughts, fault-finding mind, and always think that she is not good enough. Okay. Don't try and change her. She's good enough. That's why we can't change her, because you think she's not good enough. Want to change her. No, she's good enough. How to perceive that it is good enough and not complacent, especially at work? I think I've already answered that question many times. It's good enough to be peaceful, to be tranquil, to be harmonious. You get more work done that way. When you're struggling and striving, you get tense, you make more mistakes. So it is. There was this, now many builders here. There's one of these builders, I think they were building something in the monastery, said they were working in Sydney once, and they were working on this really very, very wealthy man's mansion. And this guy had so much money, and he told the builder, look, I don't care how much it costs, I want the very best. They're the best plumbers, the best electricians, especially the best bricklayers. And the rich man went to visit this building to see how things were going. He saw this young boy, 17 or 18, an apprentice, laying bricks on his house. He went to the foreman and complained, look, I don't want any sort of novices working on my house, I want experts. And the builder said, come over here and look at this young man. And he was laying these perfect bricks. And the builder said, look, this guy can just do it standing on his head. He had this beautiful rhythm, it was effortless. And when the rich man saw it, he said, my goodness, you're right. So that's why we allow him to work on your house. He may be young, but he's a great bricklayer. And the reason was, it was effortless. It was just going so smoothly. So many bricks were being laid in such a short time. They were all perfect bricks. Because he wasn't trying. He was just flowing. And that's how you get perfection. You ask any athlete. When they train, but when they're actually performing, they don't try at all. They get in the zone and they just watch and allow it to happen. Ask the great musicians. Yeah, they do their scales at home, but when it gets time to perform, they totally let go, they forget everything. And it just the music flows from their fingers. And that's how you should meditate. Let everything go, just let it flow, and you just don't get involved. And that's what happens, you're just watching and say, wow! All this stuff is happening, and I don't do it. It just happens when you get into this beautiful zone. And some of you, not sitting meditation, walking meditation, you find that happens when you're walking meditation, when you get peaceful. You're walking backwards and forwards. I'm not doing the walking. The walking's happening by itself. And you're just listening, and you're not giving any instructions at all. And the body is just doing the walking. And it's really cool when that happens. It just shows you just how you can let go. That's getting into the zone. And then you perform to the highest level. Try that. There is an American, Eckhart, who seems to have become enlightened through self-realization. Is it possible there are Buddhas still? A Buddha is the first person to become enlightened. People who become enlightened afterwards are called arahats. But you've got to find out if that guy really is enlightened. Just because you write a book doesn't mean you're enlightened. So to find out if you're enlightened, just make him upset. That's how we usually find out if a person's enlightened. So if Dania says she's enlightened, I say, you, a girl, no way can a girl get enlightened.
She gets, what are you saying, you misogynist Ajahn Brahm? You get angry then and say, ha ha ha, you're not enlightened. That's what we usually do. Because we just try and press the person's buttons to see if there are any buttons there. And if there are, then they're not enlightened. Assuming one heard these teachings and then jhana happened, how does one know stream meaning happened or one is on the way out? You know, because this is one something which the Buddha says, once these insights happen, you know they happen. You know the reason for rebirth, why rebirth happens, and you understand that now that cause has been abandoned. It's just cause and effect. Just like you know, if you throw something up, it comes down. It's just science, it's just law. So why do you get reborn anyway? Once you know the answer to that question, and you know the cause and you stop the cause, you know, well, there's no cause anymore, rebirth can't happen. So the knowledge comes because you see just the way everything happens. It's insight. How does one gain wisdom? Is it through deep meditation? Buddha's first two teachers had high levels of meditation. Jesus had also, did he? Didn't look like it. He never said good enough. But anyway, we don't really know too much because they don't really say too much about Jesus. But the first two teachers, did he have high levels of meditation? That's another question for another time. But you do need deep meditation. You do need the teachings of the Buddha. Those two come together and then you get deep insight. The jhana gives you the power. The teachings tell you where to look. It's like the teachings are like the map. The meditation is like the flashlight. If you're looking for your way back in the forest at night time, if you want to go back to where you belong or you want to find a treasure, you need a map, but you also need a flashlight as well. If you have a map, you know all the teachings of the Buddha, but no flashlight, no way you can find the treasure. If you have a flashlight, you have jhanas, but no map, still you get lost. When you have the two of them, you can find the Dhamma. But I'll say more about how to gain wisdom later on. Ajahn, please do not read out this message. Should I? No, I'll follow orders. Right at the very bottom, look at this. Please tell us a ghost story. Do you want a ghost story? Okay, please turn down the lights. Now come on, can you two turn down the lights? You want a ghost story, you've got to have an atmosphere. That's more like it. Very good. Still too many lights. Come, walk more out. Very good. Okay, you may have heard many of my ghost stories, but this is a ghost story for one of my friends in London. You know, in London, because it's a very old city, many hundreds of years, there's many, many ghosts. And my friend was buying a townhouse. It was about three stories. And it was going very cheap, much lower price than you'd expect in that area. So he asked the real estate agent, the seller, and the seller told him the place was haunted, it was a ghost. But my friend doesn't believe in ghosts. So he said, I'll take it, I'll buy it, even though it was very cheap. So the first night he moved in, he hadn't moved in his furniture yet, he had a camp bed on the bottom story, the ground floor. And he went to sleep, and in the middle of the night, just before midnight, he heard a sound. Rap, rap. Rap, rap! It went. And it woke him up. And he got up, and he thought there must be some wind blowing something, making that rapping noise. Rap, rap. He looked around. All the windows were secured. All the doors were closed. There wasn't even a breeze, even a slight wind in the whole room. What caused that sound? And he thought, imagination. Just I'm getting scared. Because someone told me a ghost, I'm just making it up. Because imagination can play tricks on you. So he went back to bed. And as soon as he went under the sheets, rap, rap! Rap, rap! He realized he hadn't seen it or found it because it was coming from up above, from the next story. So he climbed up the stairs, turned on the lights, and tried to find some cause for this sound in an otherwise still and empty house. He could find nothing. So he started to walk down the stairs when he heard it again, even louder, coming from the top story. Rap, rap! Rap, rap! So he went up to the top story. Even though he didn't believe in ghosts, he was getting a bit scared. Like everybody does, when you're confronted with the supernatural. And when he went up to that top story, he searched every corner. Maybe it was a mouse, but there was no holes. It was an immaculately kept house. He could find no physical, logical, scientific cause for this sound. And he thought, imagination plays such tricks. There aren't any ghosts. It can't be anything. So he started walking down the stairs. And then he realized why he hadn't found the sound. It was coming from even higher, in the attic. Attics are very spooky places. They're the sort of places where strange beings inhabit. This place where very rarely anybody goes. So they had a ladder going through this manhole into the attic. He had a flashlight. And very carefully, because he was scared now, his knees were trembling as he climbed up and pushed this square piece of wood out of his way so he could climb up into the attic. He was determined to either see a ghost, the real ghost, or find out the cause of this. And the attic, like most attics, were full of junk. Old stuff which had been stored there for years. And with his flashlight, he shone it around with all these cobwebs. He couldn't see anything. And then right behind him, rap, 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 right behind him. And he turned around and he saw it. An old piece of wrapping paper. Wrapping paper. Now what you wrap presents in? Wrapping paper goes rap, rap. It's a joke. That's a wrapping paper joke. I was told that when I was a kid. I got really scared. I told it to many other people. So that's the only ghost story you get tonight. It's not a real ghost, just wrapping paper ghost. So anyway, if you'd like to. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Some ghostly sadhus. Okay, have a great night. I'll see you in the morning. And again, if you see any ghosts, send them to me. I'm in the office. You can sort them out.